Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch this week sparked a firestorm by naming a woman who may have been the victim of a sexual assault. According to police reports, the woman had had an extramarital relationship with former Missouri House Speaker John Deal. We'll find out what our media critics have to say about all of this in just a minute. Also today, how well has the media covered the mass murder in Charleston? And how well did reporters do covering the record-setting session in Topeka? That's our focus today. Our media critics are Derek Donovan. He's the reader's representative of the Kansas City Star. Derek, welcome back.
Hi there.
Pam Fine is a journalism professor at the University of Kansas. Pam, nice to have you too.
Thank you, Steve.
Donna Vestal is the director of content strategy here at KCUR. Donna, good morning to you too.
Good morning.
Well, first things first, folks, lousy turnout in Kansas City's election yesterday, 8% in Platte and Clay counties, 13% in Kansas City south of the river. How much blame, Derek Donovan, does the media deserve for such a lousy turnout?
It's kind of the classic chicken and egg argument,
yes,
wouldn't
it
you
is.
Say?
Yes, it is.
I think every election has to be looked at by its own merits. This particular one, we had the mayor who was not unopposed exactly, but what was the final tally? What was
he had more than 80%.
Over 80%, yeah. Right. So I think a lot of times the coverage sort of comes down to when there's really a horse race, you know. But it was also covered in the run-up to the election. And I can also tell you one of the things that is a little bit sort of dispiriting to a journalist these days is the fact that you have so many real-time metrics about what people are reading. You know exactly what people are clicking on the website. You know exactly what people are getting served on Facebook. And you can tell that people just weren't clicking on any of these stories. They weren't looking at the candidate profiles. And I think part of that is just it's local government. And local government is one of those things that there's a small segment of the population that is super, super interested in it. But it's always a struggle to get the general readership into those types of things.
Well, Pam Fine, does the media need to do something then to sort of up its game a little bit to somehow find a way to interest people in these races? Or is there only so much the media can do?
Well, I think the key is to connect the topics and issues in the local community to your readers' lives. And I know the local media here in town tries to do that. I think that's the real way to spark more interest, perhaps not, a tremendous turnout, but some more is to make sure that the coverage is relevant to the community. So for those people who care about property taxes and transportation and other critical issues, you're connecting the dots for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, the experts say that the best way to get a local turnout increase is to have the local elections coincide with the national elections.
Ah.
And that's really the only way you're going to see an appreciable increase in voter turnout locally.
Well, the irony here is the city just moved its election dates into June in a bid, at least in part, to get more people to turn out to avoid these March and February and March primary and general elections when it was cold and you didn't know what the weather was going to be. And look at the result. Nothing. You know, well, what more can the media do, though, Don? I mean, the media did point out that this next council is going to make some big decisions when it comes to a downtown convention hotel and streetcars and sewer systems and these things that I guess cities deal with. What more do you want your reporters to do?
Well, I think part of the problem is we don't know what we're not getting at because we do have fewer resources in the overall media looking at city issues. And so I think we see that kind of play out. There may be some underlying issues that we do have a responsibility to put those resources toward that and figure that out. I don't really know the answer. I know that Up to Date did a great job looking at some of the issues. And
well,
we
thank
talked
you, Donna
about,
Vestal. We tried. That's
welcome.
A nice thing to say on my show.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that was the discussion in our newsroom was how do we, months ago, the very real concern about we don't want to talk about this as a horse race necessarily, but we want to be able to look at those concerns that the public should be paying attention to and that will come up and will be an impact on those areas because of this election.
And that's
hard to find.
I'm going to belabor the point here, but you know, local government is the level of government closest to the people. People seem to connect most with their city council reps, the mayor, that kind of thing. And sometimes I just wonder, as a guy who has covered politics for too much of my life, what are people thinking? Where are they? and when it comes to showing up and voting on races like this, Derek?
And I think a lot of the problem is that these national races that people get so interested in and get their passions inflamed over are partisan. And a lot of them are things where you can really argue left versus right. And these things that the TV shows especially just hammer endlessly, that's their only bread and butter. Whereas these local topics are many times a lot more nuanced. And you don't necessarily have the type of R versus D arguments over some of these issues. And so it's harder for people to get into them because they think, well, that is so arcane, I'm not going to take the time that it's going to require to actually understand this topic of financing a downtown mm-hmm. hotel or development of these types of things. So they're not easy topics for people to have an opinion about.
Yeah.
But, you know, it did feel like we used to have very local newspapers or neighborhood news sections and things like that with the Star that helped us focus on what was of immediate concern in our mm-hmm. neighborhood, in our smaller community. Mm-hmm. And I do feel like that's lacking for us right now, that connects us in that way, not about even the broader Kansas City, but in my neck of the woods of Kansas City.
So, Pam Fine, you're saying that we've moved the dates from February, March to, you know, April, June, whatever the dates were this time, that you think it might be worth taking a look at this idea of shifting them again to maybe August, November, when the national races are being staged, you know, that kind of thing?
Well, the experts, the political scientists say that absolutely would increase turnout because people are more interested in the national elections, president, Congress, et cetera, so that there would be more likelihood of turnout. Younger people in particular are less interested in local elections than national elections. They find that with women as well. So, but I agree with Donna. I don't want to let local news organizations off the hook. They need to effectively, and that means finding ways to make sure that they're doing their reporting in a vigorous way, in a way that matters, and so that important issues, pocketbook issues, social rights issues, other issues that matter get discussed. And so I want to make sure that, you know, the media onus is obvious.
Or maybe we need, you know, 2x4s and clubs and maybe cash envelopes to pay people to go to the polls to vote. I don't know what the answer is here. I wonder about it all the time.
Okay. You have a big future in big party politics.
Yeah,
there, Steve.
Whatever I have here. I need a future in something. Well, let's move on to maybe a hotter topic here. The Post-Dispatch in St. Louis last Friday published this story about a consultant who's a former aide to Governor Jay Nixon. Based on police reports, the story talked about how she was worried that she had been sexually assaulted after a night of partying in Jefferson City. And the story talked about how the story shed light, you know, on the political culture of the state capitol. The reaction of the Riverfront Times newspaper in St. Louis, sort of an alternative paper in St. Louis, the country really have come out to raise questions about this story. The Riverfront Times headline was, "How this Post-Dispatch shamed a possible rape victim and embarrassed itself." Pam Fine, did the Post-Dispatch embarrass itself here, or what's your view?
I don't think so. I think that it was a carefully constructed story. It didn't seem to me to sensationalize what happened, but that, like the editors there, I felt that this is an important story for the public to read about and hear about.
It's an important story. Why? Help me with that.
Because you have public officials who ostensibly are on opposite sides of an issue who are having an affair. And I think that the public, you know, I think that kind of activity breeds cynicism and concern. And this involved the Speaker of the House and a paid public official, lobbyist for the governor.
An aide to the governor at the time, yeah.
And it feels to me that when you have public officials cavorting into the wee hours of the night and potentially influencing each other on critical issues in a way that goes beyond what they should do in their day-to-day jobs, that the public has a right to know. There were other people involved in drinking that night, other legislators, mm-hmm. and I think it showed also who was doing the governor's bidding, that this woman had not used very good judgment in terms of her relationships with other officials.
And the story pointed out, as you're saying and suggesting, Pam, that the governor's office no longer employed this woman, at least in part because there were concerns about a potential relationship with the Speaker of the House, a Republican, Jay Nixon, being a Democrat, and she no longer worked for the governor's office after a while. Derek Donovan, what's your take on all this?
It's a curious thing that Pam brought up there, because I think that there's a lot of sensitivities here that intersect with these issues about public accountability. And the thing that I think is maybe to me the most troubling is that the takeaway from the story, and perhaps I am misreading it, but as I understood it, at the end, we still have some uncertainty on the woman's part as to whether she was sexually assaulted or not.
That's an open question. And in fact, she quit cooperating with Jefferson City Police after a while, and the case was never really resolved.
Exactly. And so for me, I hold so dearly the importance of not putting a sexual assault victim on the spot in any way when there's some question. And so I don't like to play the game of, if I were the editor, would I do it or not? But I think the story still would have worked without using her name. And would it have had the same impact without using her name? Absolutely not, because at that point she becomes something you have to take their word on it that she exists. And so anytime you're using an unnamed source, you're putting your credibility on the line. And I remain convinced that to the reader, they don't put nearly as much stock into an unnamed source. And of course, they've had reasons many times to when they've gotten burned by journalists who have had false or at least it's partially invented unnamed sources.
Mm-hmm. So your call might have been to run the story, but perhaps without the woman's name.
I think that would be one way you could go. And I would say that, speaking to Pam's point in specific, there is a lot of pulling back the curtain over how government gets made, over the process that really is happening in our state houses. You know, that's the reason House of Cards is such a phenomenal hit for Netflix, is because these stories really do go on. Scandal, you know, all this popular entertainment that gets at – it's not invented that this intrigue is going on between these lawmakers and lobbyists and the people surrounding them with all these big bucks. This stuff does go on, and I think you could make a very compelling point that a lot of state house reporters really soft pedal and are way too genteel in the way they cover these legislators who are people and who have relationships on the workplace the way that they do everywhere else in the world.
So how do you cover that part of the job, though, Derek? I mean, as a guy who's been in those trenches for any number of years, I mean, do you begin writing stories about the fact that an aide to the governor is having a relationship with, I mean, stories about who's having a relationship with anybody else, those are impossible stories to get. I've had a million tips over the years, and unless you're in the room with a couple seeing what they're doing, you don't know what's going on there.
Exactly.
For sure.
You know what all the rumor mill is.
Yeah, and I get rumors all the time.
Right. One of the things I've always struggled with, too, is what is the journalist's responsibility to report on the personality and just the character of some of our elected officials? I mean, I'm not going to name them, but there are a couple of elected officials that I've talked to in my career who are just the most abusive, horrible people you could ever know. How does a reporter really communicate that to the reader? Because obviously the reporter covering these folks know exactly what
But they might
like.
Be abusive to you as the reader's representative for the Kansas City Star, but when it comes to dealing with the line reporter day in and day out, the beat reporter, they sometimes present a very different demeanor.
Exactly. Know? And a lot of the time that beat reporter knows those two different sides of those public servants. They are still public servants. Really, is the fact that that guy's a jerk to his dry cleaner part of the story or not?
Yeah. Donna Vestal, you oversee the newsroom here at KCUR. What say you about this story and how it was handled?
Well, as I'm listening to this, I become concerned that reporters find the way into the story through a potential victim, right? They knew the story was going on. This was their way in. And they justified it with the arguments that we kind of hear there.
It was in a police report. That's
it was
how
in
they
a police report, mm-hmm. right? So that's where the name came. But she's still a potential victim. Yes, she pulled out. We know victims do that all the time. The way into this was because she was a potential victim. Maybe, maybe not. Usually we err on the side of caution, as Derek says. I would love to see this done without that. I would love to see the reporting. Okay, we know this is happening. Let's find a way to tell this story. You know, once they identify that there's an unnamed source, you know somebody else is going to name that woman. Mm-hmm. She will be outed by someone else. So, you know, I'm frustrated by this.
So you're saying find another way to tell the story, meaning try to find a way to tell a story that an aide to the governor is having an affair with the Speaker of the Missouri House.
It doesn't have to do with that night. And to me, they're also two separate stories. There's what was happening with that affair and that, you know, the Speaker of the House, who's no longer the Speaker of the House, but at the time, right?
So, yeah.
And then there's the separate issue about what's going on with the partying and the atmosphere and the way they conduct themselves.
But again, how do you get those stories?
Yeah.
Pam,
well,
you've led newsrooms in your time. How do you get that?
I think where I differ is, and I'm not intimately aware of what reporters knew, but it seemed to me that this story was really about the fact that the speaker was having an affair and that information surfaced through this police report on a guy who had resigned after it came out that he was sexting with an intern.
A different woman altogether.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that it was more about him than it was about her. And that's why I think they handled this story pretty well.
But Pam, don't we protect other sources?
Well, we do. But how do you report a story that says the Speaker of the House had an affair with an aide to the governor of Missouri, and that aide's job was to be his legislative liaison without naming her?
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
I think
couldn't you name her without that night coming into play? I mean, couldn't you do the reporting? I mean, that night she just ended up at his place,
doorstep,
right?
Yeah,
yeah, at his doorstep.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to tell your readers, well, why are you reporting on two people having adults having a relationship? And it's because there were other factors around that this woman seemed to have a history of drinking and buddying up with legislators and others.
But you see, then I have the women male issue, how we look at that and look
and him
scathingly.
Too. Well,
yes,
I mean, he was there till 3 a.m, went home. She wakes up the next morning, follows him, goes over to his house. I mean, it's a big mess.
And to be clear, the story made clear that the speaker was not involved in any untoward behavior toward this woman. That was very clear in the story. So don't want to cast any aspersions here. But, you know, the broader question here, again, Pam, this is such a tricky story. The speaker here in question, John Deal, he's resigned. He's been gone for weeks from the Missouri State House. He resigned in disgrace. So what does it matter any longer that there might be evidence that he had at least a second affair or a second improper relationship with a woman in the State House? Why do we care? He's gone.
Well, I think it's not up to us to decide exactly what the meaning of this is as journalists. I think that the public wants to know what people are doing in their name when they're executing their official roles.
Mm-hmm.
And that in this case, you had one of the state's most prominent leaders using terribly bad judgment while he was in office. And then you have a woman who's claiming that after a night of partying with legislators, she may have been assaulted.
Yeah.
It's an interesting story and one hard to walk away from. And if you're going to be it's the phrase in for a dime, in for a dollar, I think you have to name the players in this case.
I would note that the St. Louis Post-Dispatch politics editor Christopher Ave gave an interview where he said very much the same thing, that what tipped the scales for them was the power wielded by these people.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I just want to make a couple points here. I think one issue here is the ongoing story about the culture that seems to be somewhat unique to Jefferson City, Missouri, at least unique in the sense that it's not Topeka, Kansas. As a reporter who's covered Madison, Wisconsin, and Springfield, Illinois, just a little bit, and then our two states here, you know, there's something about the culture of Jefferson City. We're working on a piece that again begins to look at that. But this has been an ongoing thing that, as a reporter, I've written a lot about these questions about this sordid culture of Jefferson City. Lawmakers, lobbyists, public officials removed from their home environments for months at a time, and things happen. And I noticed it within a week or two of first arriving in Jefferson City back in the late 80s. I remember looking around thinking there's something going on in this place, you know. And I want to also point out what Christopher, I have the paper's national editor, the Post-Dispatch's national editor, wrote about this. He felt compelled to write a statement given all the criticism the paper was getting. He says, given the current climate in Jefferson City following the recent intern sexting scandal involving John Deal, we felt this story continued to reveal the behavior of public officials and those who play a role in state government. So again, that's how they handled all this.
And, you know, sometimes the events lead you to a way that's a slam dunk journalistically. Like, for example, what went on with Councilman Brooks and, you know, the alleged assault in his office. You know, that is something that, for one thing, ended up with some type of legal action being taken, you know. And so those, you don't even have to think about it. Those are stories that you just do cover.
Okay. Well, again, that's an interesting controversy involving the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, its coverage of this controversy in Jeff City. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're visiting with our media critics about a whole host of issues. If you have any thoughts or concerns about news coverage you've noticed of late that's either hit or missed the mark on recent events, give us a call, 816-235-2888. Again, area code 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR. Are up to date. Okay, let's move on to media coverage of Charleston, South Carolina, and the mass murder at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church. The media took some heat on Twitter and other sites for being slow to cover this story. Rob Lowe, the movie actor, tweeted this: "The media should be ashamed. 3 hours to get on air and then gives detailed suspect description without mentioning his race." Donna Vestal, any concerns about the media's coverage of Charleston?
Yeah, I mean, I can fault television coverage for that reason. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's a really appropriate concern. I think it should have been immediately brought to the public's attention, and it's just a horrible thing that's happened there. I do think I was fascinated reading about, when you look at where's the stories, the correct stories being done on what happened in Charleston in the aftermath. And there was a great recommendation. You know, in this case, you look to the hometown papers. Those local papers are the ones who cover this appropriately and know their community so well. And it really brought to bear to me that idea that our community is where we have the strength. The newspaper can make such a difference, and other media, and that's where I want to go for my coverage, to understand what's happening there and the tremendous fallout. Now, of course, this story expands from there nationally, and we see what's growing out of this with the worries about the Confederate symbols,
right.
And we're doing our own work related to that, and so it just spreads out from there. The ripples go from there. But in the immediate aftermath of that tragedy, looking to those local reporters, they're doing it.
But you thought that you had some concern with how TV covered,
yeah,
at least initially, in terms of identifying the race of the perpetrator here?
Yeah, or? To me, it was more the importance placed on it right away. You know, are we really covering this, or really sharing with America the significance of what has happened here?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is horrible. You can't imagine. And of course, we always say, we start to think, okay, well, if it was in a white church and it was a black man, and then how would that happen? And I hate those kind of games with this. But it did feel like 9 people shot down in a church. That's just a tremendous tragedy that, you know, and the person is on the loose. We don't have that person in custody yet. So what,
yeah,
you know, where do we go from here? Aside from the race questions.
If our listeners have some thoughts about this, 816-235-2888 is our number. The coverage of Charleston is the issue here. Pam, what do you think?
Well, I do think two things. One is that I agree, and the Charleston paper, within journalism circles at least, is given plaudits for its handling of the story, particularly with Sunday's paper and earlier editions focusing as much on the victims as the perpetrator, so that, you know, the people most impacted were reflected sensitively and effectively. I think one of the most interesting discussions that surfaced out of this is whether to call the perpetrator a terrorist. Who's a terrorist and who isn't? And so something I was thinking about on the drive into the studio, we've traditionally been quick to label external players
yes.
in the Mideast and other international sites as terrorists.
Foreign, I'm putting quotes around the word foreigners, air quotes here. Right,
right. Mm-hmm. Rather than perpetrators of domestic violence, Timothy McVeigh and others. So it's interesting about that, and we're seeing in editorials and in among other opinion journalists more and more use of that word to describe this suspect.
Mm-hmm. Derek.
You know, I think that the most interesting thing about the early criticism is this is a very good illustration of Twitter culture knocking into traditional journalistic culture. And for people who were following the story on Twitter as it was breaking, I was not one of them. I happened to have had my head buried in a project at that time. I wasn't watching any TV or looking at the internet at all. It is so easy to play Monday morning quarterback to how the traditional news outlets might have been behind what Twitter was saying about this. One of the problems, though, is that Twitter can be right. It can also be wrong simultaneously. And it could be that there are a lot of people who are sending folks off on wild goose chases. And so one of the jobs of the journalist is to get it fast, but more importantly, to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
And in these cases where Twitter does happen to have good information early, so many critics say, well, see, why wasn't thus and such newspaper or TV station doing the same thing that we were? Well, because they wanted to vet it first.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I have always lived by is that your audiences never remember if you had it first, but they sure remember if you had it wrong.
Yeah, that's so good. You know, Katie just tweeted us her thoughts on media coverage, and she writes, there can be too much focus on being the first to break news, especially online, leading to inaccuracies and misinformation. You think the mainstream media sort of gets that, Derek? People, editors holding back a little bit to make sure they've got facts straight before they run out and tweet stuff?
I think it depends widely from person to person, to be honest. When they made the arrest, when they finally captured the kid, I happened to have been watching Twitter, and the very first alert that I saw move from it, I think might have been an AP alert, but it was amazing to watch all these other sources would instantly start tweeting, media reports say that he has been apprehended. Well, in other words, my Twitter feed was saying that he's been apprehended, right?
Yeah.
Would it really have killed them to wait the other 10 to 15 minutes for the official statement to have come out, which that's all it was. It was 10 or 15 minutes after the news broke on Twitter. So this is one of those places that I think newsrooms are a little bit too concerned with looking like they're out of step with worrying, oh, we're not as fast as, you know, Joe Blow, who's watching it and hearing what Twitter is saying. So
mm-hmm.
I think there are certain places where news outlets need to maybe just be a little more circumspect and not worrying about having to, you know, this is that classic business management, red ocean, blue ocean argument where everybody's out in the blood red ocean fighting over the same information. You got to find out what you really own in the blue ocean where you've got a little bit of room to move around. And, you know, that's where journalists need to be spending their time.
You know, I don't disagree at all with anything you're saying, but I tell you, as a longtime reporter, Donna Vestal, I love being first with a big story. That's where we live. That's where reputations get made. And I'm not at all suggesting you want to be careful with your facts and make sure you get it right, because you are correct. What readers remember is they don't remember you got it first. They remember if you got it wrong. That's all so true. But in terms of professional pride, you want to be first.
Yeah, but that's just in our world, our little journalism world.
That's right.
That's
right.
All that's about. But I see it. I talk to people about it every day, this desire to be there and be the one. And truthfully, as the manager of reporters, I really try to downplay that, which is, you know, a lot of people don't agree with and don't like, and they
yeah.
want to hear that you're going to reward me if I get it right. You get it right, yes. Get it first, as long as it's right,
mm-hmm.
you know. So yeah. much more important.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll get phone calls here from Imani and Rebecca. We'll continue our good conversation with our media critics. We'll talk about coverage of the Kansas legislature. We'll talk about the guts of one state house reporter in Topeka who stood up to a meeting full of lawmakers and said, I'm not leaving this room. This is an open meeting, and several other topics as well. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about the media, the performance of the media as it's handled a range of very difficult stories. Derek Donovan is here from the Kansas City Star, Pam Fine from the University of Kansas, and Donna Vestal from KCUR. Our number here, 816-235-2888. Let's go to some calls. And Imani from Kansas City, Missouri. Imani, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. My comment is the difference in reporting of labels as it relates to recent stories in the news. The South Carolina shooter, the fact that he actually planned to go to a college and some other sites, actually terrorizing the black community to start a race war, the word terrorism was not even associated with him, whereas with Michael Brown, he was labeled a thug. Even though other people said this, they reported that labeling in the story. So I'm just seeing the difference between what happened is that this person was actually, Dylan Roof, was seen on a video camera, a positive ID, just murdered 9 people, whereas Michael Brown only had swishers, and he wound up dead. And also the person that got the rough ride that actually ended his life, both nonviolent.
Imani, excellent points. And Pam, are you noticing a difference in the media between the way reporters describe certain people based on race?
Yes. And also, as I said earlier, that we haven't come to terms with the idea of whether a guy like this is just a lunatic with a mental health problem, mm-hmm. which some people try to say, versus a domestic terrorist. And I mm-hmm. think it's going to be an interesting discussion for the news media about whether to, in fact, reframe our thinking that these perpetrators, like the guy in Charleston, is a terrorist. He's got a political viewpoint, and he's trying to affect a broader societal change by doing a heinous act.
Mm-hmm. Derek?
Yeah, the close parallel, really not close parallel, but a parallel to him is what Charles Manson did. You know, of course, this guy's got a higher body count than Charles Manson, but he was trying to incite a race war as well. And not to dispute what our caller is saying, but I do think that really largely she was talking about something for the pundit class to hash out. You're not going to find, I don't think, very many news reports out there that called Michael Brown a thug or that are going to immediately start labeling the Roof guy as a terrorist right now in a news report. But these are
maybe people quoted in the news reports may have been doing that.
Exactly. Derek. Right. Yeah. Right. You might be talking about the sourcing there. And those are two totally different things, obviously. But the words still do have grave meanings. And mm-hmm. I think that it goes to the question of whom you choose to quote, whom you choose to include as your sources.
Let me just interrupt. The Manson analogy doesn't work for me. What would work for me is the Boston bombers.
That's another good one. Yes.
I think we wouldn't be surprised to see them labeled terrorists, but Roof, we've been a little reluctant to call him that.
And
so
see,
far.
In my own little pundit's head, that was the first word that came to mind. I thought of him very much in those, same as F. Glenn Miller, whatever his alphabet soup is out of the Jewish centers mm-hmm. last year. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, that just initially just smacked of terrorism.
Let's go back to some calls here. Imani, thank you for yours. Rebecca from Olathe. Rebecca, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you. I actually think Imani hit my point right on the head. And my concern is with the social media coverage. I've seen, coverage is sort of a broad word, but I've seen all these posts comparing the reaction of Charleston to the reaction of places like Ferguson and Baltimore, and saying, in the South we do it better. Look at how appropriate we're responding. But the situations aren't remotely similar. My immediate first response to Charleston was also terrorism. And this is, I don't think having a mental health issue and being a terrorist are mutually exclusive. Hmm. And the reaction isn't the same because the reaction shouldn't be the same. They are completely separate situations, and the public response should be different.
Hmm.
Sorry.
No, thanks, Rebecca. Yeah.
That's an excellent point, Rebecca. And it's one that I actually make with readers all the time, that you can't really meaningfully compare coverage of things that are so disparate. But at the same time, regarding our earlier caller, you also can't deny the feelings that people have about the situations.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really tough when you're trying to compare apples to oranges. But it's just an excellent point you made.
Well, the common denominator is obviously race. And race is the issue that we're going to have to deal with in this country and in our communities. And clearly, as we take the story, this whole conversation about labels or whether we let someone off the hook because they're a lunatic, but they're still, it's race that's driving them forward, and there's a divide. And we are seeing it play out in separate stories, story after story. And there is a narrative here that's kind of coming together that we've really got to deal with.
Again, we're talking with our media critics, 816-235-2888. If you have a comment about recent coverage, you have questions about how reporters did what they did or decisions that editors made, give us a shout, 816-235-2888. Just one more point on the Charleston thing I wanted to get to. Fox News took some heat on this front. Larry Wilmore, the late night talk show host, said Fox was in denial about the whole Charleston thing, suggesting the shooter may have been targeting Christians, not African Americans. Said Wilmore, "I know you guys don't want to admit that racial stuff is going on, but how can there be any doubt when it came out of the gunman's mouth? He told his victims, 'I want to shoot black people.' I think when he says black people, he means black people and not Christians." And Larry Wilmore's point is that Fox, at least initially, was saying this shooter was targeting Christians, not targeting blacks. Yeah.
You know, I no longer even entertain the suggestion that Fox is pretending to do journalism anymore, and that's just the bottom line.
How do you really feel about Fox, Derek?
Yeah. But it's funny because when I came into this role 10 years ago, they were making a much more legitimate attempt to deliver the news straight, especially in their news segments. I used to listen to their radio reporting, and it was very much in line with what all the other affiliates in NPR were all doing, but it is no longer that way.
Yeah, and that was espoused by one of their commentators, but it wasn't in a formal news report. So I do think that many of their on-air folks are polemic, are definitely representing a conservative viewpoint.
Back to some calls here. Jonathan from Independence. Jonathan, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just curious. I know race is an issue, and I know we're having a lot of issues in these states right now, but I mean, I feel like a lot of it's exacerbated by the media in the first place. And is it even necessary to mention race when dealing with these crimes? Do we have to say it was a black man that killed a white woman, or do we have to say it was a white man that killed a black woman? I mean, is this even necessary to bring race into the picture when these heinous crimes even occur?
What about it? In the case of Charleston, do you have to bring race in?
How can you not? I wish we didn't have to. I wish we lived in that world where it wasn't a factor and it didn't play into how we see people, you know, move forward in life. But it's the reality.
This was a crime of racial hatred, is your point.
Yes, that's my point. And so often it is. It seems to be the case. And maybe it's a question of day to day, even how we report, you know, in the newspaper, you know, murders here or there, other crimes. Does race come into those situations?
Can I add one more thing?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously Charleston is a little bit different because that was racially motivated. But in a lot of these cases, race has nothing to do with it, but we still mention race.
Well, most mainstream media do not mention race unless there's a specific news value to do so. What it does happen, and studies show this, and there was one recently, is that TV stations seem to cover black crime and black perpetrated crime more readily than they do other crime by whites and others, so that they're we see perhaps more black criminals on local TV reports than we should. So white people think that black crime is more pervasive than it actually is.
And another factor, too, is that most homicide, I believe I'm correct in this, is intra-community. I mean, you know, most homicides are committed by people that people know. And those also tend to be people of the same skin color as well.
Back to some calls. Marty from Kansas City, Missouri, wants to talk about the broader implications of all this. Marty, good morning.
Good morning. It seems remarkable to me that the media from the outset, as Larry Wilmore pointed out specifically about Fox, but the media, including this program, seem unwilling to address that this was an act of racism. And racism is alive and well, needs to be dealt with, and I don't quite understand how the media can be unwilling, reluctant to deal with that fact in today's world. And talk about terrorism and whatever is completely a distraction.
What about the whole notion of the media, Donna Vestal, you know, dealing with the whole question of race and racism in this country? Is the media reluctant to go there or not?
I'm not sure we figured out how to go there and how to do it effectively and in a way that can keep a civil conversation going. It's just such an intense issue, and it's not just a out there up above issue. It's an issue that people deal with in their daily life and the way that they conduct their businesses and the way that they are. There are so many things. I hear on NPR that people say there were some things this morning. I think there was something about the singer. I don't know, but it just struck me as so removed from my world, and to understand that and to face up to that as a country. I agree that the media has a difficulty taking this on as the bigger issue that it needs to be. Mm-hmm. But I think we're going to figure that out. And I think, unfortunately, incidents like this will force us to figure this out and move forward with this issue.
In case you are trying to wrap its arms around this very issue.
We are.
Pam,
yeah.
What about the issue?
I was going to say I'm perplexed that this caller doesn't think race has been dealt with very directly in this case. And even my colleagues here today have said very clearly this story is about racial hatred, racial prejudice by this guy. Mm-hmm. And the end result, or not the end result, but one of the key results is that people are recognizing that, and they're removing Confederate symbols from flags, and Amazon and others are going to stop selling Confederate memorabilia and things with Confederate flag markings. So I think that this story is clearly about race, and that everybody is looking at it head on and not backing away from it. I shouldn't say everybody, but you know, I think it's very clear what's going on here.
And Pam, the media's ability, just going a little beyond here, to deal with the whole question of race and conversation, if you will, in print, online, on the radio airwaves, on TV, about race and what that means for this country, how effectively is the media dealing with all of that?
Well, you know, this whole idea of the media is difficult because it's not a monolith. There's TV, there's radio, there's multiple platforms, there's multiple players. And over the years, newspapers and television stations have reported on race, you know, in local communities, nationally. It's not something that has been ignored. Look, it was a big factor when a big discussion when President Obama was elected. So I think the media has, you know, collectively has shined a light on both the progress and the problems of race in this country. I think every community news organization keeps looking at this issue and trying to do justice on the subject. And, you know, it's a terrible, I think, miscast to say we haven't covered this issue.
Derek Donovan.
We also tend to try to get reductive about what racism is. Racism has a lot of different facets. Mark Maron, the podcaster and comedian, had President Obama on recently. And President Obama, in talking about these issues, used the N-word. Well, you know, he has taken a ton of heat from the right and from the left, from people on both sides saying that was wrong for him to use that word, and people defending him. So when you can't even have the first black president having a frank discussion of this this word that is so problematic to so many people and using it, that you're never going to be able to reduce what, quote, racism means down to a single topic to cover.
Yeah.
We get distracted.
We get distracted.
These things.
Let's move on down the line here. I wanted to turn to the recently completed Kansas legislative session, which went 113 days, the longest session in state history. Some of my colleagues over there are valiantly trying to cover this thing. How well did the media cover the Kansas legislature, Pam Fine?
Well, I think my local paper, the Lawrence Journal World, did a very good job on this subject. And I would say generally, the news media in Kansas and even nationally paid a lot of attention to what was happening in the state house. Unfortunately, it's also been brought to light again that you have fewer people covering these state houses.
Huge
in general.
Yeah.
And the Columbia Journalism Review, a writer for the trade organ publication, made the point that it took only two pizzas to feed the press corps during the session, and that was a shame.
I want to ask about one reporter in particular, my old colleague John Hanna, the Associated Press's State House correspondent. I have a lot of respect for him. The National Journal wrote a story about John's coverage that began this way. In the middle of a budget stalemate in the middle of the country, Associated Press correspondent John Hanna passes a closed conference room en route to his basement office in the Kansas State House. Glancing through a door window, Hanna sees Governor Sam Brownback's budget director addressing 27 Republican lawmakers. That's interesting, Hanna tells himself. The caucus was not publicly scheduled, as would be the custom in Kansas, with the state legislature struggling to fix an $800 million deficit, mostly caused by the governor's 2012-2013 tax cuts. A long-awaited debate on the House floor was just canceled. Why are they meeting in secret? Hanna opens the door, walks in, and stands against the wall. Quote, "This is a private meeting," one lawmaker barks. "You weren't invited." Hanna crosses his arms. "I know that," he says, nodding at the Brownback aide, Sean Sullivan, "but I'd like to hear what he has to say." After a few minutes of awkward silence, Budget Committee Chair Marvin Klebb shrugs. "It's okay," he says. "He can stay." What about it, Derek?
I think that is one of the strongest arguments for professional journalism
there
that there is out there.
Amen.
I totally understand people who say, well, I have a blog, I have a Twitter account, I can report the news the same way as any journalist. However, the whole point to why they allowed him to do it and not kick him out is because they have a lot of experience with him. He has developed a reputation with those sources. And they also have accountability to him as a professional journalist. If they had kicked him out, if they had called a guard or something, then that would have become a different part of the story as well. And
yeah.
So what he did was, it was brave to a certain extent, but at the same time, it was also the right thing to do.
Well, I want to thank our media critics today for coming in. Pam Fine from the University of Kansas, the great journalism professor. Derek Donovan, the reader's rep from the Kansas City Star. Donna Vestal, who leads the newsroom here at KCUR. Thank you very much all for a very good conversation. I appreciate it.